This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. The ongoing federal government shutdown is now the longest in American history, and it's still not clear how and when it will end. But day by day, we are seeing new examples of the impact this breakdown is having on everyday life. That includes many federal workers not getting paid, delays in air travel, and a loss in certain safety net benefits like SNAP. STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum talked with U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt yesterday in his Washington, D.C. office about that issue and many others. Jason began the interview by asking Schmidt about his prediction, which he made in an Instagram video over the weekend, that the shutdown would end after Tuesday's elections in several states.
You posted on Instagram that you expected the government shutdown to come to a conclusion after Tuesday's elections. We're here on Thursday, November 6th. The government's still shut down. What gives?
I still am hopeful that that's the case. I mean, currently there are discussions that are ongoing right now as this is being recorded on Thursday to reopen the government with probably 5 to 10 Democrats supporting that effort. So I think the more moderate members understand that this shutdown is stupid. It doesn't make any sense. We're about, I think, this weekend hitting a place where, you know, 10% of the flights will be grounded. There's just simply not enough air traffic controllers for the volume. They're not being paid. They haven't been paid in a month. So that's why I think it's going to end. I could be wrong. I said on the Instagram post, I could be wrong, but I do think there's nothing that's rational about this for the Democrats other than this is an effort by many of them to show that they're willing to fight against Trump, and they didn't want to do anything before the energy of Tuesday's election. So I think I'm still hopeful that it ends this week.
A lot of Republicans, including you, have pushed back against extending the ACA subsidies that were in the American Rescue Plan. But given that expanding affordability was seen as such a big issue in Tuesday's election, wouldn't it make sense to temporarily extend that until Republicans come up with a different sort of plan?
Well, we should talk about the affordability writ large. We can have that conversation, but let's talk about Obamacare and the effects. No one can make the argument that Obamacare has made healthcare less expensive for working families. That's not true. Healthcare costs have gone up over 80% since Obamacare. Even the Washington Post editorial board said the problem with the quote Affordable Care Act is it was never affordable. So I am more than willing to have that healthcare discussion. I think we should. I think there are ways that you can lower costs, but this effort with the subsidy, about 40% of it, if you want to get into the weeds a little bit, about 40% of it goes to insurance companies in instances where there's no utilization at all. It's a huge subsidy for insurance companies who've gotten rich on this, but it hasn't helped a lot of people. It certainly hasn't reduced the cost of healthcare. So my expectation, Jason, is that at some point, it's that once this shutdown is over, that we will have a debate about this. And I welcome that, but Obamacare has been a disaster for working families.
Another big reason why I've heard Democrats don't trust Republicans here is, in coming to a deal, is that Republicans pushed through a budget deal earlier in the year, and then there was a rescissions package, which you actually handled that legislation in the Senate. Why should they agree to buying more time to keep the government open, to have that sort of negotiation, if rescissions are always going to be on the table?
Well, so I think it's important to understand the process. All we're saying is, what is a clean CR mean? We're asking for a clean CR. Republicans aren't asking for less spending. We're not asking for more spending. I actually don't think a lot of Republicans are terribly thrilled about that, but it gives time to work on appropriations bills, okay? So one of the big things in our leadership election last year, Jason, was that my first 2 years here, there was no process. Schumer never had bills on the floor. And by the way, Republicans were guilty of this too, where you didn't have an appropriations process and you end up with an omnibus bill that's decided by four people that you see at midnight, right? So this would get us back to what's referred to as regular order. Democrats will certainly have a role to play in that. But this shutdown is about them objecting to a clean CR because you could talk about healthcare for illegal immigrants or non-citizens. You can talk about all the demands that they have. But when it comes to rescissions,
and they would say that that's not true.
Okay, well, they can say that, but it is true because they're
isn't it just based off like emergency room care for
no,
them?
No, well, part of that is, but it's absolutely true that states are using federal dollars to fund for health care for illegal immigrants.
Which, and I think is actually true in like Illinois, for instance.
Right. And so what we did is to close that loophole in the One Big Beautiful Bill that we passed. And they don't like that. So the only offer that's actually on the table by the Democrats right now, I'm not sure that's where we'll end up, is that they want to rescind all of the Big Beautiful Bill in the rescissions package, right? That's what they want to do. That's just not going to happen, right? And that's never been injected into a CR. Usually the exit ramp for funding bills is a clean CR. That's where we're at. That's where we're always going to be. As it relates to rescissions, you're right. I did handle it. There's a process. When President Nixon was impounding a lot of money in 1974, Congress passed a law saying, we're going to make sure the legislature has a role in this. And they passed the Budget Impoundment Act. That rescissions where the process comes from. So if Democrats have a problem with rescissions, they should change the law, but we certainly have the ability to move forward on rescissions.
Okay, since you are talking to a reporter for an NPR affiliate, I'd be remiss if I did not read a quote that you said on the floor of the Senate about NPR and PBS. NPR and PBS are not neutral media outlets. They're the closest thing we've ever had in this country to Pravda, which is the Soviet Union newspaper that I think still exists, but was popular when the Soviet Union exists. And then they are arms of left-wing activist class, taxpayer-funded propaganda masquerading as journalism. You know, that really hurt my feelings, first of all, but you know,
well, that's not personal to you. As you know, I actually have a lot of respect for you as a reporter. However, there's a lot of programming on NPR that a lot of people find very objectionable and biased. There's no question about that. And the truth of the matter is the $1 billion that was in the rescissions is 1% of NPR's budget. St. Louis Public Radio gets about $575,000 from NPR. That's about 6% of their budget. So we're talking about 0.06% of St. Louis Public Radio's budget.
Yeah.
And my understanding is there's a fundraising campaign that raised over $800,000. Congratulations, but I don't think the taxpayers should have to subsidize stuff that they find really objectionable.
One point that I did want to press you on, and then I will move on to other topics because I don't want to spend the whole time on this. You
sure.
mentioned a statistic from a former NPR editor where I guess 87 reporters or staffers were Democrats and zero were Republicans. I didn't find that statistic to be particularly meaningful because if they all live in Washington, D.C. or Maryland, which are closed primary states, of course they're going to vote in Democratic primaries. Like, I vote in Democratic primaries in St. Louis County because I live in a 90% Democratic area. Why use that statistic to prove bias if it's not a good one?
Well, because I hear a lot about like diversity, but it seems that ideological diversity is never really part of the discussion. I just think that's an overwhelming number. By the way, that statistic came from a whistleblower who was in fact a Democrat who found it objectionable, the bias that he saw in the DC NPR office.
All right. Now I want to move on to immigration.
Sure.
Earlier this year, President Donald Trump suggested that it may be worthwhile to send the National Guard into St. Louis at the behest of the president of Union Pacific. But given that the state just reestablished control of the St. Louis Police Department, was it wrong for the president to suggest that before state control has a chance to either succeed or fail, given that it's only been in effect for like 4 months?
Well, first of all, I talk to the president very frequently. That topic has never come up in our conversations. What has, actually, I'm very proud of this. St. Louis, our approach, my approach has been, as a former attorney general, I care very deeply about the St. Louis region as a native. We have, in the confirmation process with Cash Patel and Pam Bondi, Cash Patel talked about getting FBI agents out into the field. And I said St. Louis would be a great place to start. So St. Louis now is getting the largest per capita infusion of FBI agents to take on violent crime in the country. So that's our approach right now. I think, I mean, all options are always on the table, but I think that's sort of the approach for federal law enforcement to work in coordination with local law enforcement. I've talked to Mayor Spencer about this. I've been in communication with all the local officials on this and FEMA, all kinds of stuff. We want to try to work collaboratively. I think this is an area where you could find bipartisan agreement.
Have you been watching any of the videos coming out of Chicago?
I mean, I've seen, I'm sure, clips. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and some of them are pretty disturbing. Like tear gas in neighborhoods, people getting pushed down, even tear gassing the Chicago Police Department. I read a report, too, that the Department of Homeland Security is claiming people are assaulting ICE officers, and then those people who are accused of that are immediately released without charges. Do you think that, and it's not just ICE, it's also Border Patrol, too. Do you think that, like, there needs to be, like, a little bit more thought about how that operation is going?
Well, I think that you have a 1,000% increase on attacks on ICE agents. And I do think there is a segment, take Antifa, for example, that's very well coordinated. They throw firecrackers to get ICE agents to come out. They assault them with Molotov cocktails. So these agents are under a lot of duress and a lot of stress because they're being attacked at a level we've never seen before, all for doing their jobs. And I think what this is really about is there's a lot of people that just don't want immigration enforcement at all. And this rage is coming out on the streets. And so I think they should be protected. Obviously, I think they should abide by all protocols, but they have an important job to do, which is to enforce our federal immigration laws. And I think the violence we've seen on federal ICE agents is really disturbing. You saw that in Los Angeles, you've seen that in Portland, and you see it in Chicago.
So here's a dispatch from The Economist, Daniel Knowles. The preliminary injunction hearing in Chicago is just like normie white liberal after normie white liberal describing how federal agents beat them, shot at them with pepper balls, pointed guns at them, threw flashbangs and tear gas at them. To be clear, it was not all white witnesses. I was not there for the entire hearing, but it was striking how a decent number of the witnesses were exactly the sort of lily white, not at all activist type people who do not normally get threatened like this by law enforcement. Does that kind of cut against your idea that a lot of people on those videos are Antifa? I mean, I'm from the suburbs of Chicago. I know exactly the people that Daniel Knowles is talking about. They're not Antifa.
Okay. I wasn't following that exactly. I think, people have a right to have their opinion heard. You do not have the right to impede the enforcement of our federal laws. So if you think it's appropriate for you to like block ICE agents who are in danger of being assaulted themselves, you're wrong and you should be prosecuted for it. So I don't have any problem with, if you want to protest in the town square and you have an opinion about how ICE agents are conducting their jobs, this is America, God bless you. But that's not what's happening, Jason. There are people who are outside federal office buildings where ICE agents are located. There are people who have safe houses who they run to after they assault ICE agents in a coordinated campaign of terror and violence. And so if you want to have the position that we shouldn't be enforcing federal immigration laws, then change the laws. But right now we have a president that's gonna go do that. And I would also point this out. Bill Clinton deported 12 million people. Barack Obama deported millions of people. What is the difference? I think there's been a radicalization on the left who just doesn't believe in border enforcement or immigration laws being enforced either.
You said in your NatCon speech that there's been too much legal immigration, particularly with H-1B visas. Do you think there should be constriction on legal immigration too?
I think there's been, my point I was making in that speech was there has been abuse with H-1B, the H-1B program, no question. So for example, in the area I grew up in, North County, people were hit with this double whammy of their jobs were sent overseas to places like China. And as they looked for other employment, a lot of their wages were undercut through illegal and sometimes legal immigration. You're seeing that now with white collar jobs, right? You're seeing at Microsoft, thousands of people being laid off to bring in H-1B workers from other countries who have no particular skill greater than the American workers, except they're more compliant and they're cheaper. And I have a problem with that. And so I think, yes, is there a place for the best and the brightest, a selective group? Of course, but that's not what's happening right now. And that's the point I was making.
That's U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt talking with STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. We'll get back to their conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the St. Louis Public Library Foundation. During these challenging times, free access to digital resources is a necessity. You can help our community stay connected. Support your St. Louis Public Library at slpl.org.
Welcome back. I'm Elaine Cha. Let's return to STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum's conversation with U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt. They recorded their conversation yesterday in Schmidt's Washington, D.C. office.
You recently unveiled legislation that would target something called nitazenes. What would this bill do, and what is the broader goal you're trying to accomplish here?
So people are probably more familiar with fentanyl, which is really potent. Nitazenes can be 40 times as potent as fentanyl. So they're typically produced or sourced in China. They make their way through Mexico, typically through the cartel networks. And then for drug dealers and traffickers, it's made part of cocaine or weed or whatever. So it's potentially very, very deadly. And so it would codify, number one, making it a Schedule I substance so law enforcement has the tools necessary to enforce it and try to prevent it from coming in the country in the first place, but then also, and go after the people that are distributing it. But then also, it would give special sanction powers to the government to go after entities that are producing it. So trying to get in front of it.
We talk a lot about targeting the supply, which I think is absolutely something we need to talk about. What about the demand? Like, I don't think cartels are going door to door and just being, please buy my fentanyl or my synthetic opioids. Is it time to have a hard conversation about how Americans who take these drugs, with the caveat that sometimes it's mixed into some of the other drugs unknowingly, I want to make that clear, that their demand is partially responsible for the drugs coming into this country?
Well, I think there's two responses to that. One is, I think that take a lot of towns in the Midwest that have been hollowed out by these terrible trade policies. Jobs were sent to China, and in many ways they were replaced with drugs and despair. And I do think that's a real problem, and I think we should have policies that address that. It's why we're trying to onshore, reshore a lot of industries, bring manufacturing back, give Americans real opportunities to succeed. But I also think what's really unfortunate about all of this is that people make mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. People make mistakes, or people use drugs, and I think that mistake shouldn't mean they're dead. I understand the point. I think there are things we can do. I mean, one of the things I'm most proud of is my time as AG was the opioid settlement, which was like $450 million that's coming to the state that are available now in grants. And I think that was meant for, and I hope it is utilized for, treatment, not just to go to general revenue, but for real treatment for people to stop the addiction.
In the last few minutes, you recently had a hearing detailing instances of left-wing violence throughout America, and you often push back against people who say, well, what about January 6th? Or what about the attack on Paul Pelosi, or the Josh Shapiro arson, or the murder of the Minneapolis House Speaker, or the fact that an avowed Trump supporter set fire to a Mormon church in Michigan? But doesn't America have a general political violence problem rather than solely a left-wing violence problem? I'm not denying that there haven't been left-wing people who have killed people. Like, the congressional softball game is clearly an example. But could you respond to that point?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to note that about 2 months ago, I sponsored the condemnation in the wake of what happened in the one-year anniversary of Butler, in the wake of what happened in Minneapolis, condemning all forms of political violence. And I don't think there's any room for equivocation there. All forms should be condemned. Free speech, yes. Political violence, no. However, if you look at the raw numbers and the incidents from Charlie Kirk to, you go on down the line, I won't list them here, we can give you a list, it is overwhelmingly coming from the left right now. And that is also buttressed, Jason, by some really scary polling numbers, which is 25% of those who describe themselves as very liberal are willing to tell a pollster that political violence can be justified, compared to 3% of those very conservative. Now, that's within the margin of error of zero, but let's just say it's 3%, that's 3% too many. But the fact is, that's not the same thing, right? And you have 55%, according to recent polls, who think that the assassination of President Trump would at least be somewhat justified. That's pretty chilling.
Which poll said
I think that's
that?
A YouGov poll. I think it's a YouGov poll, and we're happy to get it to you. So
let me just say, I disagree.
No, I know that. But I think that something
not
is,
that you were accusing me, but continue.
I know. Something has happened on the political left here that is outsized, and I think we need to get out in front of it.
You have also mentioned that you want Antifa to be declared a domestic terrorist organization.
Foreign terrorist.
But Antifa isn't by its nature a pretty disorganized and just like a, it doesn't seem like it's an organized entity like, I don't know, the Communist Party or Al Qaeda. It's just sort of a ethereal belief in anarchism, basically.
Yeah, I disagree with that. I think if you dig a little bit deeper, and we're happy to provide you with some of the evidence we've uncovered so far and why we've asked the State Department to designate them an international or foreign terrorist organization in addition to a domestic terror organization, is their funding is international. They have networks that tip off people. They have international safe house network that people can access. So I think this is much more organized than people think.
My last question for you, I do want to touch on the elections of Tuesday.
Sure.
I think we need to be careful about drawing a line between now and a year from now. A lot could happen.
Yeah.
But I saw a Facebook status about how you thought it was telling that the Virginia Democratic Attorney General candidate won. And I've seen those text messages. They're grotesque. Yeah. I want to make that clear. But couldn't you also say, and you could maybe extrapolate this to all the results, that the fact that somebody that flawed and somebody with that little self-control won over a Republican incumbent attorney general showcases just how damaged the Republican brand is, not just in Virginia, but New Jersey, California, Mississippi, Georgia?
I don't know, man. Like, I talked about this rise in political violence on the left and 25% saying political violence is justified. And Virginia just elected a guy who fantasized about killing his political opponents and his kids. So I can't answer why, but I think that's sick. I also know that in New York, a self-avowed communist.
Democratic socialist, but I understand it's now, it's now, you know, cause celebrated to call him a communist.
Commie Mandami.
Yeah.
But anyway, that he was elected. So I agree with you in the sense that I think it's hard, and I said this ahead of time, so it's not like armchair quarterback. I think it's hard to extrapolate an election in 25, not even a midterm, in blue areas or blue states. I don't think you can draw some big conclusions from it. I will also say that the Republican Party now, which, as I've told you before, I feel very much at home now, is more of a working class party. It's a broad based political party, which means there's more lower propensity voters in the party. So unlike before, when I was growing up in Missouri, Republicans perform better in presidential years than they do in midterms. And that's a challenge long term. I'd rather have that problem than the other side of it. But so again, I don't think there's too much to glean from this. I will say this, though. I think there is a very important conversation that needs to be had on the Republicans, and I hope to lead it, about these affordability issues for young people.
Yep.
Like, the average age now of somebody who's married, has kids, and owns a home is 37 years old.
Sensodyne toothpaste costs $10 now.
Yeah. So,
which is, you know.
Yeah.
But for a family of three, like, that adds up.
I know. Yeah. So I think this is a real thing. And
not
so,
to say that all my kids have sensitive teeth, but you understand my point. Continue.
No, right. But no, I think this is a thing. And I don't intend to, like, pretend it's not a thing. I think we should, Republicans, conservatives should be leading on this and make sure that voices like Mandami don't fill that void.
That's STLPR politics correspondent Jason Rosenbaum talking with U.S. Senator Eric Schmidt. And joining us now is Jason from just outside the U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. Jason, what stood out to you in that interview?
I think there were a couple of things. One was how Senator Schmidt seems to think there could be an endgame soon to the government shutdown. He had predicted, as you heard in the interview, that perhaps the stalemate would be broken after Tuesday's elections. It was Thursday when I interviewed him, and the government still shut down. So it didn't happen instantaneously. That was one thing. I think the other thing that I wasn't really surprised about was on the whole issue of immigration. Senator Schmidt has become seen as a very hardline immigration policy person. And I'm not surprised he's supportive of sort of the tactics that are being used by the Trump administration, even though they have provoked widespread outcry wherever they're occurring.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk more about immigration. Jason, you asked Senator Schmidt about Governor Kehoe mobilizing the Missouri National Guard to St. Louis. What did you make of his response to that?
I think that, and I remember when President Trump made those remarks in the Oval Office, I just think that that was not an idea that had a wide range of support among Missouri's political leaders, who are more often than not, as you know, Republican. I think, as I said in the preamble to the question, Missouri just reestablished state control over the St. Louis Police Department. So if St. Louis crime is out of control, then really it's the responsibility of the state government for that result, which I don't even think it's really that fair right now to say, because state control hasn't been in place long enough to really make that determination. So I think that Senator Schmidt was clearly more comfortable with having an increased FBI presence in the St. Louis region. I understand that any federal presence in any city, given this administration, is going to provoke a lot of pushback, but I think that that is probably going to be less controversial than the National Guard being used to help fight crime, either directly or indirectly. And in most places, it's been indirectly, just supporting immigration enforcement efforts.
Jason, you also asked Senator Schmidt about his characterization of the protests against ICE, and you noted that the protesters in Chicago didn't seem to fit his description of Antifa militants run amok. So the senator didn't exactly answer your question, but he did double down on ICE agents being the ones in danger here and that the law needs to be followed. What was your impression of his take on this part?
I wasn't surprised that he doubled down. Again, like, this has been a pretty consistent view that there should be, in his opinion, like, widespread immigration enforcement, mass deportations, however you want to call it. But I mean, I've been watching those videos pretty carefully, Elaine, because a lot of those places in Chicago are places that I frequented a lot growing up there. We're in a place like Evanston. My mom lived there for a long time. And some of the neighborhoods where there were either Border Patrol or ICE agents looked very similar to my mom's neighborhood. And I know those people well. I don't know every single person that lives in Chicago or the Chicago suburbs. But for the most part, like, they do not fit the characterization of anarchists who want to run amok on things. They're people that don't want ICE or Border Patrol or federal agents in their neighborhood throwing tear gas. And I think seeing those images, I think since those images have been broadcast so widely across the country, it is probably a big reason why Donald Trump's approval ratings on immigration, which used to be his highest issue, have gone way down. And I'm just not even sure how effective this strategy is toward even enforcing immigration laws, especially if the people that are being detained, like, we don't even know if they're in the country unlawfully. So I don't know. I wasn't surprised by it, but I've seen those videos with my own eyes, and I think a lot of other people have too, based off the poll numbers.
Mm-hmm. And earlier, Jason, you had described your being in D.C., and that is where you talked with Senator Schmidt in his office. Can you share why you are in the nation's capital now?
Well, I wouldn't usually go to Washington, D.C. for fun, because especially with the airline travel situation, it's actually a little bit more nerve-wracking than usual. But I am in Washington, D.C. to take part in a panel about redistricting for NPR's Weekend in Washington, which is a pretty big event for NPR. I am really touched and honored that I will be joining people from the state's team, basically, and also other reporters who have covered redistricting. Redistricting, I feel, is an extremely important thing, that it not only affects people obsessed with geography like myself, but also how people are represented in places like Washington, D.C. and Missouri. So it's great to be here. I just hope I'm able to get back to Missouri, given that air travel might be restricted. So I might become St. Louis Public Radio's Washington correspondent temporarily until I come back.
Well, we're proud of you wherever you are and so grateful for your work. And we do hope that we'll see you back here in St. Louis as soon as possible. Jason Rosenbaum is STLPR's politics correspondent. Thanks for joining us, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
And I, our executive producer, Alex Hoyer. Recorded by Jason Rosenbaum and Alex Hoyer. Edited by Danny Wisentowski.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.